Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts we think you would enjoy. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour that blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we've got more dwarves and dragons than we know what to do with, but we'll be using the latest Hobbit film to talk about the art of the second installment. Sometimes they're welcome, sometimes they're just weird, and sometimes they're actually better than their predecessors. In the last show we'll be sending you before Christmas, we'll also check in on holiday music. There's a piece that's been kicking around from one of our pals about the lack of good new holiday songs, so we'll run it up the North Pole and see if the reindeer will eat it or something. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us for our discussion of holiday music, previously known from our discussions of Captain Phillips and Punching Robots, our pal Chris Klimek. Chris Klimek, what do you do not at NPR when you're not guesting on Pop Culture Happy Hour?
I am a freelancer in Washington, D.C., and I'm in the job market. So.
Chris is available.
Reach out, folks.
Chris is available. Well, okay, so we should say we are taping this show almost a week after we taped our live show,
right,
which you will receive next week and the week after that in two pieces as you hear this one. So at our live taping on Tuesday the 10th, we pointed out that Glenn was trying to make us see The Desolation of Smaug.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he won that argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw The Desolation of Smaug.
We sure did.
I'm going to let the nattering nabobs of negativity begin the conversation, then I'll just come right in at the end there and just sort of save it.
Just give us what for.
Yep.
Put us in our place.
Yep.
I thought I wanted to go last.
Nope. I think you should go before me. I just have that feeling.
Would you like me to kick
it off, Thompson?
All right. I did not necessarily hate The Desolation of Smaug. This is the second of the, I know it's a
just
carve it into a mountain.
Yeah.
My issue with it is, as we know, just to, in case there are those who are not up on the Hobbitverse, it is the second installment, second 2 hour and 40 minute installment in what will presumably add up to a gigantic, epic 8 hour telling of a very short book, in which dwarves in a mountain and there's treasure and there's a quest. And this movie picks up, obviously, where the first movie left off. The first movie was like, we have completed one third of an adventure. And then why they can't just ride the giant birds all the way to the mountain and spare us the gigantic quest to the mountain, I do not know. But this picks up with more orcs getting stabbed in the face and beheaded and fight, portent, dragon. And it was kind of the Hobbit, a long day's journey into Smaug. there wasn't a lot of Smaug. There was a lot of desolation, a lot of getting to the desolation. It also very much to me felt like they made an 8 hour movie in one piece, start to finish, and just lopped this clean out of the center. So it just picks up and leaves off, unlike a movie like Catching Fire, and we'll get more to other trilogies, those will be made into four movies, but you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm, where Catching Fire felt like a complete piece in and of itself, even though it obviously isn't done telling the story. This really was like, and now another fight. Nope, it's the end.
Yeah. Chris, how did you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, our pal Alan Scherstel, Glenn and I know this guy, he's a film editor at the Village Voice, and he wrote a review of this film that I really liked, where I think he said something like, this is what a 12-year-old would think of as all good parts. And I think that's right on. He also called it the culmination of the entertainment industrial complex, something that J.R.R. Tolkien would not have recognized. I mean, I preferred it over the first installment.
Well, fewer tea parties.
Sure, yeah. There's less dishwashing and singing about housework. And then, you know, we've probably kicked that one enough. And, you know, when I started getting into fantasy and sci-fi and comics and stuff, one of the big attractions for me was that it was this dense mythical world, and you were just sort of expected to keep up to figure out who all these people were and stuff. And I kind of liked that there was so little reaching out to people who don't. Yeah, exactly. People who didn't see or don't remember that they saw. What was the first one called? An unexpected journey. Right.
Yeah. Since Glenn insists on going after me, I will just say I legitimately hated this movie.
Wow.
The first one, as you may recall, I said I found it slow, but parts of it, I got why people like it. I tried very hard to interrogate my own response as to whether I just don't like fantasy movies. This movie I legitimately could not stand. This movie I just legitimately think is not good. I think it looks awful. The fights look fake. It looks like a video game. Nothing in it looks remotely... I mean, it's all Uncanny Valley to me. It doesn't look real, and it doesn't look whimsical. There's this bizarre sequence that looks to me like fire-breathing Georgia O'Keeffe paintings that I thought was very upsetting. And this one felt to me like... The way it's pitched is it's just an endless series of... The peril is announced. Bong. The music goes bong. It narrows in on someone's face going, and then there's a near miss, and then nothing happens, and they go to the next thing. And this happens like 20 times. And by the end, by like the 6th or 8th or 12th time that somebody's about to get hit with an arrow when, donk,
clang,
the person gets hit or, you know, when this happens about 10 times in the same movie, nothing matters. Nothing in the film feels important. Nothing in the story feels like it means anything. And then you get to the end and nothing happens. And you're like, are you kidding me? I just sat here through 2 hours and 40 minutes of nothing happening to get to an
ending
where nothing happens.
Even though all it is things happening. And you made a point, Linda, on Twitter that I really, really agreed with, where you described it as the tone of this film never changes.
No, it's all at like a 7.5. I could not stand it. This is the first movie I have ever gone to for this show where I sat in the theater thinking, could I make a good contribution to the show out of getting up and leaving? Because I so badly did not want to be sitting there spending my time watching that movie.
This is extraordinary because I don't remember hearing you hate something before. And I'm not going to defend...
Oh, she does all the time. Okay, people, especially.
No,
yeah.
No, but like how Steven felt about Man of Steel is how
right.
I felt about this
no,
movie.
No, and I'm not going to fall on my sword defending
it.
This movie like I tried to for Man of Steel. Although I will say that this movie, I think, is guilty of humorlessness, the charge that was applied to Man of Steel. Just a lot of... I mean, Martin Freeman playing Bilbo Baggins. You know, you expect
more...
With no
lightness.
Right, exactly. You expect more exasperation. He's just kind of a, you know, sword impaling... Tough guy all the way through this thing.
This is another you touched on a very important and very damning point about this movie. You said it looks ugly.
I feel like I'm expected to sort of say, well, whatever else that you can say about it, it looks amazing.
Right.
And then you have to have the argument from there. I don't actually think it looks amazing. When I look at the scenes of people riding ponies and various animals off into this, it looks no more realistic to me than a high-end video game. I still completely recognize that this may be a reaction that has nothing to do with anyone except people whose thing this is not, but it is not my thing and I did not like it. And I will let Glenn explain why I'm wrong.
Okay, where to begin? All of you are not wrong. It sucked. It was bad. This is a bad movie. Because we talked before about action versus spectacle. And action, when you see action on screen, your first reaction is emotional because you can locate the human in it. The stakes don't have to be explained to you or contextualized in any way. You can see it. You feel it. When you see spectacle, your first reaction is purely intellectual. That looks impressive. I'm sure that cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And this movie is all spectacle without a variation in tone, as you mentioned. And it's like we have now reached a part. This year, it really happened where... Because CGI can do a thing, there are filmmakers who feel it's a mandate to do a thing.
Right.
And that's just not the way. This is like the difference between action and spectacle is the last 20 minutes of Die Hard versus the last 20 minutes of Man of Steel, where one feels completely cold and you are so far removed from it. And the waste, I want to talk more about Martin Freeman, because say what you will about Elijah Wood, you know, he's got those big Disney woodland creature eyes.
Yes, he does.
But he wasn't...
They're wider than his waist.
Exactly, they are. He wasn't called upon to do a lot in the first trilogy because, you know, it's like Peter Jackson would go up to him and go, okay, this scene, you're more tired. than you were in the Silver Fern. So the entire trilogy is going, oh, Sam, I'm so tired. Oh, the ring, it's so heavy, Sam. But here, Martin Freeman is a real actor, right? And not that Elijah Wood isn't, but, I mean, you can see stuff playing across, or at least you should be able to see stuff playing across Martin Freeman's face, like the tension between cowardice and courage. That should be a thing that you should just, because the film is called The Hobbit, and we don't see nearly enough of Martin Freeman. We are off exactly what you said in all these battles where, I mean, a Tolkien fanatic would say, well, actually, elves should be much better fighters than orcs. It should be effortless because they are hundreds of years old, thousands of years old, and orcs are mass-produced and... And so it's a thing between, you know, finesse in battle versus just sheer number, but it looks fake. There are two moments in the book, the slim, light little book that this is based on. Yeah. Two moments in the book that you actually remember, and they're both moments of dialogue. The first one is the Gollum Bilbo riddles in the dark.
In the first film.
Yeah. Which actually, that film lived up to. The film became much better because it handled the tone of that. The second in the book is the dialogue between Smaug the dragon and Bilbo, which is about, it's a pure fairy tale. He's trying to trick the dragon. But let me talk briefly about the 1977 Rankin-Bass animated version, which is the one that I grew up on. It's the one that I went from that to the books because I loved it so much. That thing has not just great voice actors, but great actors. It has Orson Bean as Bilbo, John Huston as Gandalf, and Hans Conried, come on, as Thorin. Yeah. It's a little tough to get used to because it also has Glenn Yarborough as a balladeer who sings songs like this. It's terrible. But it has Richard Boone. Now Maggie Thompson, who's in the studio with us, knows who Richard Boone is. Richard Boone played Paladin on Have Gun Will Travel. By the time he played Smaug the Dragon in this thing, he had this really rich, gruff, lived-in brown liquor kind of voice.
Right.
And his delivery... I mean, I looked for it online. I couldn't find it. But basically, his first thing he says to Bilbo is, "Well, thief, I smell you. I feel your air. I hear your breath." Because dragons, let me tell you something about dragons. Dragons.
Wilford Brimley?
Basically.
Falstaff, I'm thinking.
Basically, everybody else in the show is doing this fakey British accent. He's the only American, and he's the fat, lazy dragon. and what he brings is world weariness. He's slothful. He's a creature of sloth. And so what that does is it gives him a place to go with the scene because he has to, by the end of the scene, get angry and want to go out. Benedict Cumberbatch, I will not say a bad word about Benedict Cumberbatch because I know the demographic of this podcast.
Yeah.
But let me just say, he was directed to start that scene at 11. So he starts with, "Well, thief," like that. Come on. There's no place to go.
The other thing is they clearly processed the heck out of his voice.
Yeah.
And so his voice comes out as, to me, generic.
Yep. Yeah.
And I thought,
even sound like
why
that?
Would you get this guy who, if you've seen him on Sherlock and you've seen him in other stuff, you know he has like this, he does have an interesting kind of persona and quality. Mm. Why would you feed it through what really sounded to me like an electronic generic dragonizer that turned it into the same rumbly British, yes, it's rich and it's resonant and it makes the theater shake because they kicked up the bass 100 notches, but it doesn't mean anything.
It's all just mustache twirling. The dragon doesn't have a mustache, but it's twirling it through.
And it is like all these things to do, all these acrobatic things to do, which are not in the book. This just endless scene goes on forever. After the talking is over, there's all this chasing, which is just tedious because, again, it's flatly asserted. The same level of intensity, 11 all the way through. It was disappointing. It was very disappointing. I can see as a hardcore fan like me wanting to see, well, what's it going to look like? But I can't see anybody who's not a hardcore fan being remotely interested in this. Because you've already seen it. That's the other thing. Like, we've already seen this world building was done. It's been done in the last set of films. So what are we getting here?
And that's kind of the other thing that I really noticed about this is that I felt like the first one, it was a little tough to follow if you're not a Tolkien person. It took a while to kind of get into it. This one felt actively hostile to me as somebody who... I feel like, okay, I haven't read the book. I get it. I haven't even seen the other movies, and I've acknowledged that from the jump. But to me, if I'm coming to the second movie in the Hobbit trilogy, and I saw the first movie in the Hobbit trilogy, I should not feel completely lost in the first 3 minutes about what in the heck is going on and where I am and why any of this is important. And they keep dropping these references to people and places. And if you're not it felt to me like they were at the point where they were like, you know what? If you're not a deeply involved member of this kind of society of people who follow this closely,
right.
then we don't really want you here, and we don't really want you to see the movie, and we don't care.
In Marvel comics in the 80s, they would always have asterisks in the dialogue boxes, and the, you know, there'd be a little note. This happened in Spider-Man 360, editor.
Yeah.
And those were all over the place.
I don't mean to ask for hand-holding, but it felt hostile.
At the end of this film, my 12-year-old son leaned over to me, and he said, "Wow, that just kept going, didn't it?"
Because they communicate exclusively.
Right. So Alan is wrong about what 12-year-olds like. Then it is not all good parts.
Yeah.
So to broaden out a little bit, as we intended to do.
Let's do.
Instead of pummeling this movie for
to broaden out a little bit, as we intended to do, into second films. You know, the interesting thing is, just because you have a story that you're breaking into three pieces does not have to make the middle part dull, as Stephen was talking about. I felt like Catching Fire was a good movie, and I think everybody thinks The Empire Strikes Back is a good movie,
mm-hmm.
right?
All-time
Dark Knight Returns?
Top 10, for sure. Well, the Dark Knight.
Just The Dark Knight.
I'm sorry,
right.
Yes. The Dark Knight, yes.
The Dark Knight, right. The Dark Knight, and I mean, there are...
Spider-Man 2?
Spider-Man 2
Clearly
is
better.
Aliens?
Spider-Man, oh, hell yeah. Well, Aliens is different, but just
a
different genre from Alien, just as good an action movie as Alien as a horror movie.
Yeah. And you certainly have second films like Godfather 2 and stuff like that, where people will argue, as they have about Spider-Man 2 in some cases and that kind of thing, that they're actually improvements.
Right.
Which is funny to me, because it really used to be, and granted, as we're saying, trilogies, preconceived trilogies are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have these follow-ups that are sometimes considered better, whereas when I was growing up, the concept of the sequel was generally that it would be junk.
Yep.
And that it was kind of, I mean, there's a reason why the Electric Boogaloo cliche right. developed. And I'm going to tell you, Electric Boogaloo is a lot worse than the first Breakin'.
Right.
That is actually true.
Okay.
Breakin' is a bad movie. Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo is a terrible movie. And that...
Bite your tongue.
I have seen both in the theater. I'm just saying. The thing that is funny to me about this is you see a movie like this and there's no longer any sense of whether it's going to be better, worse. The only thing you know is it's going to still make a ton of money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because no one cares and everyone goes anyway.
The estimate used to be that they would do 60, 65% of what the original did.
Oh, and now like they're 200%.
Supposed to. Right. Or, yeah.
Right. Well, that's like The Hangover Part 2.
Yeah.
Like, which nobody seemed to think was particularly
right.
awesome, but it made.
Because they did
of
so
money.
Much world building in Hangover 1. But they can now just settle in and tell the story.
Okay.
But I mean, sometimes I think what happens is you get the cumulative gross receipts of, like, everybody who ever went to that movie presumably then goes in the first week. And so you get these mammoth, you know,
but
these
that didn't
mammoth...
used to be the case. Like, it
no,
didn't
I know.
Used to be the case that we assumed that if you liked Ghostbusters...
I mean, Back to the Future 2 was not bigger than Back to the Future, as
well,
I,
or,
as
and
I
some
recall.
Of them were outright duds. Like, I was... Like, just because you saw Ghostbusters doesn't mean you saw Ghostbusters 2.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know? There was a Ghostbusters too.
Yeah, yeah. Too hot to handle, too cold to hold.
The cold Ghostbusters and they're in control.
Thank you, Chris.
That should have been the subtitle, though it was not. Okay, actually, can I say something? I have a theory about two second installments. One is one generation old and one is two generations old. But I think I know why some sequels that are not designed as, you know, a trilogy from the outset sometimes work.
Lay it on me.
Okay, so the two films that I want to talk about are Terminator 2, Judgment Day from 1991,
mm-hmm.
and Magnum Force from 1973. Magnum Force was the first sequel to Dirty Harry.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What both of these movies do is they sort of invert the premise of the original.
Right.
One of the reasons that Terminator 2 is so good is by the middle of that movie, Sarah Connor has become a cold-blooded killer who wants to go take out Miles Dyson before he can invent Skynet. And the Terminator, the T-800, is now sworn not to take a life. So he is trying to stop her from killing. So we've completely flipped the equation from the first movie. And Magnum Force, you know, Dirty Harry, of course, was this, you know, like right-wing reactionary vigilante thriller from 1971. And in the sequel, he comes up against guys who are, like, to the right of him. It's this little murder squad within the San Francisco Police Department, and they expect him to support what they're doing. You know, and he's like, no, what? You guys don't get... No, I don't think we can just kill people without trial. With it. And so the movie was sort of a reaction to outcry that the movie caused, you know, with its sort of inflamed argument against due process and all that stuff. So both those films, I think by inverting the premise of the original movie, they managed to be surprising, you know, and just kind of milk something out of it that you wouldn't expect.
So the second Hobbit movie would have been better if in the second Hobbit movie, the dragon looked for them.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
Yeah.
You know, we tend to deify Empire Strikes Back nowadays, but if you remember, people were incensed about that ending. People were angry about that ending.
No, sure.
Even though they got a big, huge plot bomb at the very end, was like, what? Mm-hmm. Talk about a reversal. That ending was incredibly unsatisfying, and people were vocal, very vocal about it. Kind of the same what thing rose up at the end of this film, at the end of the Hobbit film.
Yeah. So. Although I have to assume that people were not terribly surprised that they were left with nothing having happened.
Sure.
Since there's a third of the book, and it appears to be the part where everything happens.
Mm. No, I thought this was the one that everything happened, and the third movie was them walking back.
This was, as I mentioned before, this was my favorite part of the book because of all the good stuff that happens. I'm here to tell you, bail out now, because the last part of the book is just a giant battle and then walking home. Yeah. So I don't know if you are in.
And then the last 40 minutes are just the dishes have all piled up, and so they have to have another.
To do more dishes. Bah. Anyway, so come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you thought about this second installment or what you think about other second installments. And, you know, I'm sure we'll return to this in the future because, you know, the good thing about sequels is there is a limitless number.
I would like to hear a spirited defense of this film. I would love to hear it. I read the Entertainment Weekly review, the B+ Entertainment Weekly review, and we did not see the same film.
Yeah, I've been hurt.
No, I mean when the third installment comes out and all four of us are replaced by guests, those panelists will have a good time talking.
Yeah,
about it.
Trey Graham is going to owe us a lot for the fact that that he wound up not having to go.
Come back to us, Peter Jackson. I mean, Peter Jackson made Heavenly
of course,
Creatures.
I know.
He is a brilliant filmmaker when he's trying.
I know. Eventually we will get through this trilogy and other things will be marketed. So speaking of things that are marketed heavily, it is the holiday season. And recently our pal Chris Klimek had a piece in Slate that was so widely read.
Uh-huh.
It was so much discussed that Chris wound up on CNN.
I know.
Am I correct, Chris Klimek?
I did make it onto CNN for a couple seconds.
What did you do on CNN?
I pithily restated the... I mean, it was mostly Jake Tapper doing the restating. But,
right.
But they used a couple seconds of me scratching my chin over...
yes, Jake, that's
wondering
correct.
Wondering why all of the attempts to create another, you know, secular pop Christmas classic have kind of...
Well, let's get to the thesis of your piece, because the headline, can you state the headline for me? It's like there hasn't been a hit,
but... Yeah, it's basically that, you know, I realize that it's been 19 years since All I Want for Christmas Is You came out. So that's a...
By Mariah Carey.
Yes, that's basically a generation. And, you know, you just can't think of another pop Christmas song that's had that kind of cultural impact or even sales impact. Like, it's still hovering around the top of the iTunes page and the holiday section.
Right.
It's at the top of the Billboard Digital Songs Chart, or it was, you know, a week ago when I wrote the piece. It's a 20-year-old song, you know, and it's not like there haven't been other attempts by contemporary pop stars like Lady Gaga.
There's a gigantic churn every year.
Yeah.
Right, and we should point out, Chris's point here is not there hasn't been any good holiday
music. You're not saying not good songs.
No. It's just that we have not embraced them the way that we embraced All I Want for Christmas Is You, Paul McCartney, Wonderful Christmas Time.
Don't even say the words.
Okay, well, you know,
say the words. It's like an evil gnome.
Right. My point is simply that you know the song. Not that people love it or they hate it, but...
Wham's Last Christmas.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that one's 29 years old. That was 1984. Mm-hmm. You know, Run DMC, Christmas and Hollis. I mean, these are songs that get played again.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason, but it's like they got in before the door shut.
Yeah.
So you, the headline of this piece, as I recall, ended with the word why.
Yeah.
And I felt, and I get a sense maybe you didn't write the headline to the piece.
I didn't write the headline, no.
But I felt like the piece didn't answer that question.
Well, I loved the piece. Yeah, well, I mean, all I can do is speculate as to why. And I mean, one thought I had is that as, you know, the business model of music distribution has gone more towards individual tracks, there may be less incentive for people who don't necessarily want to write a Christmas song because they like Christmas songs to make the attempt, because if they're just going to do what, say, Mary J. Blige has done in her new Christmas album this year and just record 12 very familiar standards, you know, in the old days, you would get a royalty, you'd get a songwriting credit that you had, whether people were buying the album for the other songs or not. you know.
Yeah.
And but now, I mean,
there's still an incentive to write a Christmas standard, my God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, as Stephen Colbert told us in that great song 5 years ago, another Christmas song, there, if you do it right, you know, they'll come back and reward you.
Well, and you,
every
I was
12 months.
And I was really glad that you seized on that Colbert Christmas record in the article, because I do think that's the closest that we've come to songs that really have the potential to, you know, deeply get their hooks in future generations. I mean, the song, you mentioned the song in the article, There Are Much Worse Things to Believe In.
Yeah, I love that song.
Which is a beautiful song and a very sincere song, and it is ultimately a defense of sincerity in the face of a lot of hostile or ironic or just negative holiday music, which is, you know, one of the big things that people coming back to is as they're constantly trying to come up with a new way to approach the holidays.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Where one of my possible answers to the question of why is concerned is that Christmas is so bound up in nostalgia that so much of the way each one of us, certainly in this room, relates to the holiday is based on our youth, is based on, you know, a memory of a family ritual or you know, or something to that effect. And so in order for holiday music to fully enter the canon, we have to have been swimming in it for a little while.
Well, I think we have to kind of talk about something you touched on before, which is how these things penetrate the culture. That model, as you say, has changed, but also the source has changed. It used to be Tin Pan Alley, the Brill Building, Broadway supplied an endless churn, as you say, of popular songs, of pop music. That's where it came from. And then album-oriented rock started to produce the popular songs of the day, and that's where you get things like Fairy Tale of New York, I mean, alternative stuff. And then it was hip-hop and R&B, and that's how you get All I Want for Christmas is You. And so now, where does that stuff come from? If there's all these different threads, I mean, should we be looking for the next dubstep? Is dubstep,
right.
Or should,
well,
is EDM going to produce the next standard? Which
yeah, I mean, there is. It doesn't seem like hip hop is that interested anymore. And I mean, I'm sure that people will send examples of new hip hop Christmas songs and stuff. But you know, again, we're talking about the cultural penetration is the phrase that I keep using, like the Run DMC song had, or even the Curtis Blow had one called Christmas Rappin'. It does not seem like the current generation of hip hop stars, for whatever reason, really want to take up this mantle. And I would love to hear what they're doing. If there's stuff that I'm not aware of, and you know, and listeners want to send those in, I would listen to them eagerly. But pretty clearly, hip hop is the dominant pop form now, right?
And it's a dominant pop form. I do think, though, that one of the issues you're dealing with is how many dominant pop forms are there? Mm-hmm. You know, that as the culture, particularly in music, becomes more diffuse, you know, there has been a Justin Bieber Christmas song, and there has been...
Yeah, only 2 years ago.
You know, and there's a Kelly Clarkson Christmas record called Wrapped in Red that's out now. Leona Lewis has a holiday record. I mean, so there are large pop stars putting out holiday music, but I think, first of all, in order for a standard to emerge from that, there has to be original material. And you mentioned that the Mary J. Blige record doesn't have any original
material. Right, and the Clarkson one does, the Leona Lewis one does, and but they both seem like they're sort of calibrated to sound like Phil Spector produced them in 1963.
Well, right, and I do think there's something to be said for the fact that part of this is about the fact that we associate Christmas music not just with lyrics that are about Christmas, but with music that sounds like Christmas, mm-hmm. that sounds like Christmas music to those of us who, like Stephen was saying, have a certain nostalgic association with Christmas music. So there are sort of two different ways to go, and I actually have clips for both. There are two different ways to go, one of which is to make Christmas music that sounds like the rest of your own pop music. And this is my example. Can I get a little Elf's Lament, Sarah Ventry?
For who's been naughty or nice, but consider the price to an elf.
Okay, so that is called Elf's Lament. It is off the Bare Naked Ladies record, Bare Naked for the Holidays, which, by the way, is awesome. And
it sounds just like a Bare Naked Ladies.
And it sounds just like a Bare Naked Ladies song. It doesn't sound like a Christmas song.
It's like when They Might Be Giants started making children's music, and
right.
It was exactly the same as...
It does not sound like a Christmas song, but it's a great song. And in fact, when I listen to that song, the main thing I think is I'm impressed and glad that they spent that melody which, by the way, on the record, they perform with Michael Bublé, which I consider kind of a funny little Christmas in-joke, on a Christmas song, because that would have made a perfectly good, catchy pop song, and they spent it on a Christmas song, which is essentially about, it is the labor complaints of elves who are talking about their difficult lives making toys.
But there's no cue, right? There's no clue at all. There's no jingle bells in the background, nothing, right? There might be.
I don't think so, yeah. Other than the use of Michael Bublé.
Yeah.
And
that's the jingle bells personified.
Exactly. The other way to go is to make something that sounds kind of like Christmas music, either very traditional Christmas music or kind of something that sounds spiritual or churchy in a way that might sound...
It has signifiers.
Has signifiers. Sarah Ventry, I need a little I Pray on Christmas.
I pray on Christmas pop, 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 that the Lord pop, will pop, see pop, me through. Pop, pop, I pray on Christmas pop, 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 He'll show pop, me pop, what to do. Pop, I pray on Christmas pop, 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 He'll help pop, me understand. Pop, 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 and I pray pop, on pop, Christmas pop, pop,
So that is Harry Connick Jr. from his first Christmas record, which is called When My Heart Finds Christmas. And incidentally, the song When My Heart Finds Christmas, which is not that song, sounds like it could be on an Andy Williams record. And is not quite as good of a song, but is this incredibly thick kind of pudding of music that sounds exactly like it could have come off an older record. But that one, I Pray on Christmas, is not necessarily a traditional Christmas song, but it is a very churchy song. It's been covered by the Blind Boys of Alabama, and it's been covered kind of quite a bit, and is starting to pop up on people's Christmas records and stuff like that, because it has kind of a Christmassy, churchy feeling.
And a classic feeling.
And a classic kind of feeling.
But the classic feeling isn't necessarily, it doesn't make a good case for it. Friends of ours have a lot of the Andy Williams Christmas specials on disc, and we watched them thinking, oh, this will be fun, we'll kind of make fun, it'll be, but it's impervious to irony, that stuff, because it is pure, the blandness is to the bone. There is no, you can't find a wink, you can't find anything beyond what is being presented to you unbelievably straight. And the Osmonds, of course, were guest stars. I mean, it's exactly what it sets out to be in this kind of ultimately creepy way. And because you can't react to it by making fun of it, the only thing to do is to say, oh, we have to do something very different than this, which is how Woodstock happened. I put it to you that the Andy Williams Christmas specials are what caused Woodstock. Boom, cause,
and therefore
effect.
The sexual revolution.
Exactly. That all came later.
When I pitched the Slate piece, I mean, it kind of got away from what the original pitch was, but it was going to be more about the process of writing Christmas songs and less about the business side of getting the public to accept them. I've been asking songwriters when I talk to them for the last couple years how they feel about when they attempt to write a Christmas song. I asked this of Amy Mann. I asked Nick Lowe. I asked Rhett Miller. You know, basically what I asked them is, are the rules different? You know, is something that would strike you as too sentimental for one of your regular songs now okay? Because you know that you're working in this nostalgic vein. Nick Lowe, who I talked to for another piece this year, he said that he found it liberating. He said he realized that he's constrained by questions of taste when he's writing ordinarily.
And those go out the window.
Yes, that's it. Out the window is exactly what
he
said.
But they do and don't. I mean, that Nick Lowe record, Quality Street, is fairly tasteful. Yeah,
Christmas at the Airport is actually a very subdued Christmas song.
Right, and I think that one strikes the right note because it's funny, but it's not mocking.
Outside the taxi window, on the way to catch my flight, I notice snowflakes playing in the ever-failing light. When he dropped me at departure, it was really coming down, deep and crisp and even. It settled on the ground. It looks like Christmas at the airport.
And I do think one thing that happens is that just like you're talking about, sometimes the feeling, one thing that I think keeps songs sometimes from making it into the canon, quote unquote, is that they have a different emotional pitch. Like, Stephen likes a lot of sad Christmas music.
Yeah, I do too.
And sad Christmas music is a great thing and everyone should know it and it can be incredibly beautiful. But for example, the other clip that I personally brought is from a song that is very much about, specifically about, how you go about dealing with Christmas when you have had something bad happen and when you are in grief and when you have had a difficult year. Can I have my other clip, Sarah?
One tiny child can change the world. One shining light can show the way. Through all my tears for what I've lost, there's still my joy. There's still my joy for Christmas Day.
Oh, apparently so.
That is, that's the Indigo Girls.
Take it down a notch.
That is the Indigo Girls. That song is called There's Still My Joy. It was written by Beth Nielsen Chapman. It's been covered by Aletha Adams and Roberta Flack and Melissa Manchester and a couple of other people. And it's very, very, very pretty. And it's about kind of going to deal with Christmas. And that line about one tiny child can change the world sounds like a bank commercial until you realize that she's not literally talking about, she's talking about the imagery from the Christmas story, but not necessarily embracing literally the Christmas story. She's saying, I'm surrounded by this story and this imagery, and this is how I turn it to be positive and to mean something to me. And that song makes me cry so much. I'm so impressed I haven't cried. Anyway. So.
Well done. Well, I brought one, and as Chris and I have agreed, we both enjoy a little melancholy with our Christmas. We could go into a whole thing on like why Christmas is the saddest holiday. And I think my working theory is that it's the one day of the year that you're supposed to be happy, mm-hmm. which forces you to take stock.
Seasonally mandated goodwill. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the song I picked, and it's interesting, you know, one of the theories that I was batting around as we were trying to figure out whether aren't as many new songs being added to the canon is it just so picked over? And to find a different way into a relatable idea, you know, you mentioned Nick Lowe, Christmas at the Airport. This is another Christmas at the Airport song by a singer I've mentioned on this show before that I'm a huge fan of named David Mead. And the song is called The Smile of Rachel Ray. And it's and it's not on an album of holiday songs, but it is unmistakably a Christmas song. Sarah, why don't you hit me with a clip?
It's getting hard just getting home. There's a line in Hudson News through the shirts and souvenirs, and I'm pushing through the frame. There on the shelf of magazines, like a beacon on the bay, is the smile of Rachel.
And so the song is setting up Rachel Ray's grinning mug in contrast to this counter-narrative that is incredibly sad as he's, in a sense, and as the song reveals as it goes, getting really farther and farther away from what he's looking for. And it's this very, very beautiful, unbelievably wrenching song. I love it. And obviously, it's melancholy enough that it's going to have a tricky time entering the canon, but it gets my vote.
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
Oh, I got none. This is not my time of year.
No,
I mean, my list goes to Fairy Tale of New York and The
Nothing.
Waitresses.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Waitresses song.
This is, you know, I'm a guy who thinks that Pottersville would be a much better place to live than Bedford Falls. You got honky tonks, you got juke joints, you got real men drinking real hard drinks to get drunk fast. Furthermore, in those bars, if you remember, we don't want characters around here giving the place atmosphere. That, to me, I hear that, and that reads to me, okay, you with your artisanal bourbon and your mustache and your arm garter, you're not in this bar. You're not allowed in this bar. It is a much better place to be.
That is kind of a how to get Glenn in the door. Is the
exactly.
whole we don't want characters providing
exactly.
atmosphere.
Let's just get drunk. So I don't. I didn't.
Well, we haven't actually let Chris play any music. So what did you want to play for us, Chris?
Okay, so I think the one that I think had a real shot at coming into the pop canon, and clearly its moment has passed, unless Richard Curtis wants to put it into a movie in 5 years. Or something.
Yeah.
The Killers have this annual tradition where every December they release an original charity single. You know, I'm sort of hot and cold on that band, but I love that they write a new Christmas song every single year and that they very often are in a different genre from the prior one. I have not loved any of them as much as I loved the first one from 2006, which is called A Great Big Sled. Oh, there are the bells. They've got your signifiers.
Yep. They sure do.
So I think this would fall into the category or the taxonomy that you gave of just making a song that's sort of in your signature style that you're going to plug
in. It sounds like
The
Killers with bells.
It does, it does. Although it contains the lyric, "Little boys have action toys for brains," which I feel, you know, I feel like a little butterfly with a pin in my chest under a piece of glass when I hear that line.
It is a little cold.
Yeah. But I you know, just imagine what Mary J. Blige could have done with it if she had been willing to cover it on her new album.
We don't need
another little drummer boy. We need you to try it.
You need people to keep trying. Well, I think what we would say is if you're interested in holiday music, if you dig a holiday tune, go out and find new holiday tunes. You know, everything does not have to be a cover of whatever. Jingle Bell Rock. Once again, come and find us on Facebook, and I have a feeling you guys can probably go on about this for a really long time, and we're going to love it, so come talk to us.
So, Chris, give us the cutoff year, like after X. We want to hear about songs from after X that should be in this canon.
Well, it's got to be 1994. That's when All I Want for Christmas Is You comes out.
Yeah, that's the challenge. Mm-hmm.
All right, fair enough. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, as mentioned earlier on this podcast, my dear mother, Maggie Thompson, is in the room with us. And because my mother, Maggie Thompson, has been in town, I ended up going to a black tie gala at Jeppy's Entertainment Museum in Baltimore.
Right. I've heard great things.
Did you wear the shirt with the tuxedo printed on it?
You know what? It is. I bought this tuxedo in 2004.
Nice.
Thinking, you know what? I'm not going to rent. I'm going to have one. And then all the various galas that I will be attending, it will pay for itself. At this rate, it will pay for itself in approximately 50 years.
Yeah.
But the part of what's making me happy is it still fit.
It's like The Secret. You get the tux, and then the tux events
come
to
you. And then the fets just...
Invite me to your galas. The occasion of this event was celebrating a new exhibit in Jeppy's Entertainment Museum in Baltimore of African-American art. And, you know, it was a lovely evening just in general. It's a terrific exhibit. But more to the point, it gave me an opportunity. I've been to Jeppy's Entertainment Museum before. And if you haven't been there, especially if you have any kind of proximity to Baltimore, it is an absolutely wonderful experience. And one of the most brilliant things that they have done in this museum is rather than simply situate all the pieces at eye level around this museum, they extend up to the ceiling, probably 20 feet high, gigantic, you know, movie posters and old advertisements and cereal boxes and whatever. And when you look up at it, it recreates the sense that you're a kid. It recreates the sense where, like, so much of how you viewed popular culture as a small child, you were looking up. And so I kept walking around in childlike wonder, just goggling at even things, you know, things that might have been 50 years before my time or exactly in my time. It was a wonderfully immersive experience. I highly recommend it.
Childlike wonder.
Childlike wonder.
Gets the approval of Stephen Thompson.
Jeppy's Entertainment Museum in Baltimore.
Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Well, I can pander to the pop culture happy hour constituency with the best of them. So the first of the two things that is making me happy is this. This is my District of Columbia Public Library card.
Look at you.
After, he is showing us his District of
yes,
Columbia
after,
Library.
Yes, after 8 years in D.C., I have finally applied for and granted.
And granted.
Yes. They agreed to give
I got
one.
In. But since I'm sitting in Trey Graham's chair, what I will do is say that what is making me happy this week is a piece of theater that anyone who lives in D.C. or can get to D.C. can go see at the Studio Theater. This is the U.S. premiere of a show by a British playwright named Sam Holcroft. It is called Edgar and Annabelle. And all of the references that I want to use to describe this play are from cinema. You know, it's a little The Lives of Others. Mm-hmm. It's a little Rafifi. It's a little Truman Show. But the action is confined to this house where we for reasons that are not immediately clear, we see that this couple sort of living out this kind of scripted Ozzie and Harriet sort of existence where they believe they may be under surveillance at all times, so they don't want to say anything incriminating and stuff. But what gradually, without giving too much away, sort of emerges is that they are part of this resistance movement in this police state. There's actually a familiar NPR voice that has a small but critical role in that sort of ends keeping with the tradition.
Oh, see what you did there.
Oh.
Yes. See what you did there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I feel like deft. I'm in the company of a master.
Deft. You didn't even feel the cut.
No, not at all.
But this play performs a very, very tricky sort of moral calculus upon you, where you realize about halfway through that you're rooting for the bomb makers.
Nice.
And that's a really uncomfortable place to be, but sort of miraculous. You don't expect to feel that halfway through a story. Anyway, so the play is Edgar and Annabelle at the Studio Theater, written by Sam Holcroft and directed by Holly Twyford, who is an actor who is familiar to DC audiences, but she's got a career as a director now. It's terrific.
Fabulous. Thank you, Chris Klimek. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I crave your indulgence because this piece that I'd like to play is pretty long, but it builds, and I'm telling you it's worth it.
All right.
Christmas! Hello, everybody. My name's Pee-wee. What's yours? Welcome to my special Christmas special, starring me, Pee-wee Arden, and Terry, Conky, Annette Funicello, Whoopi Goldberg, Magic Johnson, Ray Jones, Katie Lang, Little Richard, Joe Rivers,
Jean-Claude could be in this.
Oprah Winfrey, and Princess Zsa Zsa.
Princess Zsa Zsa. You see what I mean? It builds. Builds. Builds to Princess Zsa Zsa.
It's like Children Go Where I Send Thee.
Yeah. It's a lot.
It's exactly
so that's,
like
that. Of course, that's a theme song. We've talked about this before in the show, but it's available on YouTube, and if you're not watching it this time of year, you're doing yourself a disservice. Pee-wee's Christmas Special.
Thank you, Glenn. I appreciate that, Glenn Weldon. So making me happy this week, I think we did not ever return this time around to our TV pool picks.
Oh.
From the fall. But Steven's TV pool pick was Masters of Sex on Showtime.
It was.
And this show is really, really wonderful and has completely, I feel, delivered on the promise of its pilot and second episode as I originally saw them. The performances in it, Michael Sheen and Lizzie Kaplan are the leads as Virginia Johnson and Bill Masters and Johnson of the Sex Research. And there are a bunch of other people in it as well. Beau Bridges is in it, and he's wonderful. Allison Janney is in it,
Woo!
And she's astonishing.
She really, really is.
She's astonishing in this. And I think what makes this show interesting to me is that it is about a bunch of different things at the same time, legitimately. I don't think it's a terribly faithful retelling of the actual Masters and Johnson, but what they're doing is they're telling a story with a bunch of different kind of pieces that get at how sexuality at this time, which is basically the late 50s as of this point in the series, how it was affecting all kinds of different people, how it was affecting gay people, how it was affecting married women, how it was affecting single women, single men, married men, how people looked at remaining single versus getting married, what the role of religion was, what the role of, you know, what pregnancy meant to people in a different way than it does now. And very much the way the medical establishment looked at sex, and they do get at some of the basics of the Masters and Johnson research. Like, they spent a good chunk of the first season kind of discussing the basics of female sexuality in a way that now people just take for granted. But you hear them kind of excitedly announcing things, so to speak, that that women just take for granted about themselves and that women now are raised to know about themselves. But in the time of these researchers, it was like, right, okay. Which, of course, they get to by, you know, hooking up electrodes and stuff like that to people and watching them have sex and watching them masturbate, because that's how you do it when you want to do sex research. And this was, of course, terribly scandalous and caused all kinds of controversy. But it's a show about scientists. It's a show about society. It's a show about culture. It's a show about gender. And it's really smart, and I really enjoyed it, and I'm very, very impressed with it. And I have to say that, you know, Stephen definitely, I think, wins the pool. Stephen wins
outright.
The pool on quality. You know, the pool's always really been about
this time that should be the metric.
It's a little bit apples and oranges, right. Cable versus broadcast, but I definitely give it to Stephen on quality. So,
well, I'm pretty smart,
and that is what's making me happy this week. And if you have Showtime, it's probably on your on demand, and that's what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I dislike Stephen STEPHEN. You can follow Chris at CTClimic. That's KLIMEK. And you can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our special, wonderful producer doing the job for us this week on a musical episode, the hardest kind. And we are very grateful, Sarah Ventry at Sarazona, Sarazonah. That's Sarazona with the H at the end. And you can follow our pal Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now, and you might hear something in it that sounds suspiciously like bells. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. The next 2 weeks, you will be hearing our live show, and then we will see you after the new year. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts we think you would enjoy. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour that blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under Podcasts.